Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the war in Iraq reappeared on American TV screens last week when the Iraqi government decided to confront Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's militias, mostly in the southern city of Basra and parts of Baghdad. Those paying attention to the corporate media's coverage of the fighting could have been easily confused by the dominant storyline. We'll try to sort all that out with Raed Jarar, Iraqi analyst and blogger. Also on Counterspin today, the U.S. press had been ignoring Somalia for years until 2006, when the U.S. government began alleging the Islamist governing forces there were linked with al-Qaeda. A U.S.-backed attack on Somalia by Ethiopia, replete with U.S. bombing, followed, and a more U.S.-friendly regime was installed. How the press abetted the official and inaccurate propaganda campaign and war is the subject of an article in the new issue of Fares Magazine Extra. We'll be joined by its author, Julie Haller. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
It almost goes without saying that the line on presumptive GOP presidential nominee John McCain is that he's a straight shooter and a champion of ethical government. It's also a given that the press corps, for a variety of reasons, really like him. So what do they do when his behavior is at odds with his reputation? In the April 7th edition of Time magazine, reporter Michael Scherer noted that McCain has carefully crafted an image of a, quote, saint operating in a sinner's world, close quote. This is complicated by the fact that McCain happens to also be a vigorous fundraiser who surrounds himself with lobbyists and who leans on corporations to let him use their private jets. All of this makes McCain, according to Scherer, not an easy man to judge. Actually, that behavior, saying one thing over and over and doing another, shouldn't be that hard to judge at all. There are even words for it, like hypocrisy. But the media tendency to soften the impact of McCain's less-than-straight talk is pretty widespread. An LA Times story on March 27th recapped a McCain foreign policy speech that was noticeably more conciliatory than his campaign rhetoric, stressing the need for diplomacy and coalition building. The Times called it a political pivot. If a lesser politician behaved that way, it'd likely be called a flip-flop.
On several occasions, we've mentioned how, in order to discuss Iraq in mainstream media, one must have supported the war to begin with. In other words, those who most Americans think were wrong about the war are the only ones invited to discuss the occupation and, this is a long shot, the remote possibility of withdrawal. Now things are apparently even getting bad for pro-war pundits. Take pro-war, pro-surge pundit Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institution. In February, when stories about Iraq dropped to just 3% of total news stories, according to the March 31st New York Times, O'Hanlon complained to the paper that he hardly receives Iraq interview requests anymore. I was getting on average 3 to 5 calls a day for interviews about the war. In the first years, said O'Hanlon, now it's less than one a day. Well, what is a war pundit to do? Well, for one thing, rely on CNN, which, hearing his complaint, compliantly called the thinker and, quote, invited him to tell us why voters continue to care about Iraq, close quote. While O'Hanlon blames the press for his declining use by the media, there is another possibility. As the website Think Progress argued, O'Hanlon has linked himself very closely to the White House's Iraq policy, which hasn't exactly been a rousing success. But as Think Progress also points out, it's not as if the media have totally abandoned discredited pundits. O'Hanlon has written 13 op-eds in 4 of the most influential newspapers over the last 7 months. It's tough to be silenced like that.
The March 28th New York Times had an article on Deputy Secretary of State John Negroponte's recent contentious visit to Pakistan. Perhaps the most startling encounter, the Times reported, was a quote-unquote deliberately pointed question asked by a Pakistani academic at an embassy reception. The question was, how is Pakistan different to Honduras? Negroponte's answer, as reported by the Times, you have put me on the spot. This exchange might have been startling to many New York Times readers as well, since Negroponte's role as ambassador to Honduras during the Iran-Contra scandal has been seldom discussed since he's become one of the Bush administration's top intelligence and foreign policy officials. Times reporter Jane Perlez helpfully explained that he led efforts to overthrow the Sandinista government in Nicaragua and was, quote, criticized for meddling in the region and overlooking human rights abuses in pursuit of United States foreign policy goals, close quote. The Times summary is more forthright than some U.S. media accounts of Negroponte's role in Central America, some of which have described his oversight of the Contra guerrilla army as an unproven allegation, or even as something that he was accused of overlooking, as opposed to running. What's remarkable here is that it took someone from outside the U.S. press corps to bring up this very relevant history. Indeed, Perlez described it as startling that anyone should bring it up. Bringing up an embarrassing past effort to overthrow elected governments is not something done in proper journalistic circles.
On April 2nd, the New York Times noticed a trend that, if true, would indeed be worth celebrating. Under the headline, "Like the candidates, TV's political pundits show signs of diversity," reporter Felicia Lee told readers that cable news channels, quote, "have given new prominence to a handful of contributing commentators from varied backgrounds and perspectives, blacks, Hispanics, and women," close quote. Of the 16 newly prominent pundits, all are women and or people of color. If you consider diversity only a matter of race or sex, then this is obviously pretty diverse. If you factor in the ideas they share when they're on TV, it becomes a lot less so. Of the 10 African Americans, 4 are conservative or Republican strategists, and 6 are Democratic strategists or progressives. But 2 of the latter, Juan Williams of NPR and Fox, and Democratic Leadership Council head Harold Ford, are probably best described as centrist or conservative Democrats. The 3 Latino pundits are all Republicans or conservatives. Far-right columnist Michelle Malkin, who is a Filipina American, also makes the list, as do liberal radio host Rachel Maddow and right-wing talker Laura Ingraham. In total, that's 9 conservative or Republican pundits versus 7 progressive or Democratic ones. Not counting Williams or Ford, conservatives outnumber progressives by 9-5. In other words, this new media diversity is, well, a lot like the old media. It leans to the right. It's all the more glaring considering the political context. The communities that are being represented here, blacks, Latinos, and women, really aren't being represented since they tend to vote overwhelmingly Democratic. The Times reported that CNN President John Klein said that diversity of the Democratic field explains this new diversity in the media. But that really only points back at the problem. Why do the media have to wait for the slow-motion march towards political diversity at the top of the political world before giving us even a limited glimpse at diversity in the political discussion?
And finally, speaking of that lack of diversity, MSNBC host Chris Matthews, like many of his media colleagues, spent a good deal of time talking about Barack Obama's bowling score recently. That might be bad enough, but when you listen to what Matthews and his guests were saying on March 31st, it's actually much worse. Here's a clip.
You know, Michelle, this gets very ethnic, but the fact that he's good at basketball doesn't surprise anybody. But the fact that he's that terrible at bowling does make you wonder.
Doesn't surprise anybody
either. Well, it certainly doesn't surprise anybody black, I can tell you that.
Is black a bowling? I don't know. I guess everybody bowls.
This is just killing him. This is just killing him, Chris. Don't show this.
No, we're doing it again. This is a killer. Look at this killer. Because it isn't, you know, it isn't the most macho form there, I must say, but who knows?
So the fact that the black guy's good at basketball shouldn't surprise anyone, and his bowling style isn't very macho. What a great new diversity we're seeing in the corporate media.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group, Fair. Fair also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show.
The Iraqi government late last month launched an offensive aimed at Shiite militias led by cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Suddenly, the Iraq war that had been forgotten by so much of the corporate media was back on the front page. But the dynamics of this particular struggle were likely very difficult for the average reader or viewer to comprehend. The media didn't exactly help sort things out. Our guest co-wrote an article that did do just that. 5 Things You Need to Know to Understand the Latest Violence in Iraq was the headline of the alternate piece by Josh Holland and Ra'ed Jarar. Ra'ed Jarar is a blogger and political analyst with the American Friends Service Committee. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Ra'ed Jarar.
Thanks a lot for having me.
It's hard to imagine that this far into the occupation, we're still sorting out who's who and why they're fighting, but that seems to be where we are. In the article that you wrote, you note that the line on this story, or one of them, is that the Iraqi government had to crack down on these nasty militias in the south of Iraq. You argue it's really only half right at best. It's really cracking down on some militias, and perhaps it's even a little misleading to talk about Iraqi forces per se battling Shiite militias. Tell us what you mean.
I agree with you that the latest conflict in Basra exposed a lot of misconceptions and wrong analysis that the mainstream media has been adopting for the last years. The mainstream media has been saying that the main reasons for the conflict in Iraq are sectarian and religious conflict, but the conflict in Basra was between two Arab forces, two Shiite forces, and more importantly, two governmental forces. So this breaks all of this analysis about the fight usually happening between Sunnis and Shiites, or between the government and, you know, these crazy militias, outlaws, groups. So while the majority of Iraqis don't view the central government's army as a national army, they don't recognize it as an army. Many Iraqis call this army armed militias of the government, or they call it the governmental militias, because they realize that it's not really a national army that includes people from all around Iraq to protect Iraq as a nation. It's more or less the militias of the five political parties that are controlling the executive branch. There are two Shiites, two Kurds, and one Sunni party that control the executive branch, and their militias are usually called the army, while the other political parties who are outside the executive branch, they call their militias, extremists or terrorists. But for an Iraqi individual, both sides are actually militias with different political agendas.
And we talk about these political agendas because it does seem to be most of the coverage is written along the lines of a sectarian or religious ethnic conflict. There are actual political disagreements that they're fighting over, it seems. What are those? How does that political dimension play into this story?
The political split that puts al-Mahdi army and al-Sadr group and al-Fadila party on one side and the Supreme Council of the Prime Minister the Supreme Council of Al-Hakim and Al-Da'wah party of the Prime Minister on the other side, this political conflict is based on Iraqis' vision of the future of their country. So there are three major points that Iraqi political parties agree or disagree on. The first one is whether Iraq will be one united country with one central government, or whether it will partition parties in the executive branch, including Al-Hakim's Skiri and Al-Maliki's Dawah party, are for partitioning, while Al-Sadr and Al-Fadila are nationalists against partitioning and for a central government. The second point is how to deal with Iraq's natural resources. The parties in the executive branch want to privatize them and decentralize the revenue distribution and the income and contracting, decentralize them. So they want to reduce the authority of the central government, while the other parties, like Sadr and Fadila, are for centralizing everything and giving all of the political and economic powers to the central government. And the last and maybe most important point when it comes to U.S. audience, is that the two parties backed by the U.S. are for continuing the occupation indefinitely, while the two parties that the U.S. and their allies are attacking, Al-Sadr and Al-Fadila, are against a U.S. presence in Iraq. They are actually demanding to set a timetable for a complete withdrawal, the same way that other Sunnis and Shiites and Christians and seculars who are nationalists are against any foreign intervention, whether this intervention came from the U.S. or from Iran or from Al-Qaeda or from whomever.
You bring up Iran, and that it doesn't take long for coverage of Iraq to bring Iran into the picture. NPR's Daniel Shore was trying to explain this fighting, and he said that it had one aspect of being a proxy war, the United States fighting against Iran. Iran is backing their group. United States is backing Maliki. So there you have it. Is he right? Is it Iran on one side and the United States on the other?
That's completely wrong, and it's very dangerous to say these things, because such analysis are actually one major part of the U.S. government's propaganda in the region, trying to justify a new war on Iran. While the majority of Iraqis would agree that Iran is interfering in Iraq in a negative way, they will say this not because they will think that Iran is fighting against the U.S. presence, for God's sake, because they know that Iran is supporting two Iranian parties in the government who happen to be the Bush administration's allies. So there is no such a thing as an Iranian-American conflict in Iraq. Iran and the U.S. are exactly on the same side of this conflict. The Iranian government and the United States government are funding and supporting and training and protecting the Supreme Council, led by al-Hakim, and the al-Dawah party, led by the Prime Minister, Mr. al-Maliki. These two parties are Iranian parties. One of them was established by the Iranian Grand Ayatollah Khomeini in the early 80s, and the other was hosted by Iran for a few decades. Now, to say that Iran is supporting other Iraqis against their own parties is really stupid, and it doesn't build on realities on the ground. That said, this doesn't mean that the other parties in Iraq are not using Iranian weapons, but accusing al-Mahdi army of being loyal to Iran because they have Iranian weapons is equivalent to saying that al-Mahdi army is loyal to Russia because they have AK-47s. I mean, it's true that they buy Iranian weapons, but politically, they are against an Iranian intervention. They are against partitioning. And they are against all of the Iranian government's agenda in Iraq and the Iranian allies in Iraq.
And finally, we just have a little bit of time, but I know George Bush, when he was weighing in on this, said that this was a defining moment for Iraq. Do you think he's right, perhaps for the wrong reasons?
I think it is a defining moment. It was yet another defining moment that exposed the failure of the Bush administration and their allies in Iraq, and exposed how unpopular they are. We saw that al-Maliki, the prime minister, asked his opposition to surrender within 72 hours and give away their weapons. But what the Iraqi people saw that was that in 72 hours, al-Maliki's own militias surrendered their weapons to their opponents. This was a very humiliating slap on the face for al-Maliki and Bush. It was a defining moment that showed Iraqis who are Sunnis and Shiites and others who are against the occupation that they are still the majority and they are still in control of the situation.
We've been speaking with Raed Jarar. You can read his piece, Five Things You Need to Know to Understand the Latest Violence in Iraq, at alternet.org. You can also read his work at his blog, Raed in the Middle. Thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
In late 2006, a U.S.-backed attack on Somalia by Ethiopia, which included U.S. bombing raids, replaced the Islamic courts and militias governing the country with what the New York Times deemed, quote, Somalia's first politically viable central government since 1991, close quote. Today, with Somalians saying life was better under the Islamists and the viability of the installed government in question, we'll have a look at the role the U.S. press played in supporting the invasion and what followed. With us to do that is Julie Holler, FAIR's former communications director and the author of the report Rediscovering Somalia, appearing in the April edition of FAIR's magazine Extra. Welcome back to Counterspin, Julie.
Well, it's good to be with you.
Julie, your Somalia story begins back in 2006 when the White House began a propaganda campaign to paint the Somalia government as a looming menace.
Well, it's really just the same old Bush administration strategy that we've seen before with Iraq, for example. They painted the Islamic courts as extremists. They talked about them being terrorists. They said that they were controlled by Al-Qaeda. They talked about them being a threat to Ethiopia, who's Somalia's neighbor, as well as to the U.S. Talked about Taliban, talked about Sharia law. So basically any sort of war on terror buzzword that you could think of, they threw at Somalia and at the Islamic courts that were in control. They were painting the Islamic courts as the aggressors so that then when it came time for an invasion, that could then be interpreted as self-defense, is in the interest of the Somali people suffering under this terrorist regime. The problem is that none of this was really true. There was no evidence that the U.S. administration presented in support of these accusations, and most experts agreed that it was a pretty big exaggeration of the truth. There were Al-Qaeda members living in Somalia, probably still are. That could be said of the United States as well as for many U.S. allies, so it's not necessarily a reason to go invading a country. The Islamic courts was really a homegrown movement. It grew out of the instability in Somalia. The country had been ruled by warlords for a long time in a vacuum of power, and the U.S. had actually supported some of those warlords in their war on terror. Experts actually argue that the Islamic courts came to power as a result, in some ways, of the CIA support for those warlords. So the U.S., in the end, found themselves having to invade a country because of the people that they ended up sort of putting into power there.
So the White House employed all these buzzwords, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, in order to paint these Islamic courts as a greater threat. How did that campaign, that White House campaign, resonate with the media? Did you see very much press scrutiny of the White House? I mean, this isn't the first time around the block on these kinds of charges.
For the most part, the media really just ate it up and followed the officials' lead. There was some critical coverage here and there. McClatchy, in particular, who Counterspin listeners will probably recall, was one of the few who engaged in some critical reporting in the lead-up to the Iraq invasion. Otherwise, the media was remarkably unskeptical. Television, in particular, they would report the official allegations as fact, basically no effort to seek out any dissent, which was not hard to find. Even inside the government, there was questioning of this line that was being presented of the connections to Al-Qaeda.
I wonder if you could say a word or two about the press's role in the actual invasion.
When the invasion started, the media was basically just as unskeptical as they were prior to that with the allegations about Al-Qaeda. The Bush administration had a very clear media strategy going into this. They wanted their role in the invasion completely hidden from view. They wanted this to be an Ethiopian invasion. And they wanted the media to focus on the U.S. role in diplomacy and trying to seek a diplomatic or political solution rather than a military solution. And that really worked for a while. For the beginning of the invasion, the reports were all about how the U.S. had, you know, basically the U.S. hadn't been involved in Somalia for a long time, ever since Black Hawk Down. They basically turned their back on Somalia. And now suddenly they found themselves being sucked in unwillingly into this war, and you know that the U.S. was working hard for this diplomatic solution, that Ethiopia was just acting in self-defense, when in fact Ethiopia was the one who was sending troops across the border into Somalia before the war actually started. So it was clear even then that the U.S. was not a disinterested party. Soon evidence did start emerging. As soon as the first U.S. airstrike happened, the cat was out of the bag, and the U.S. couldn't hide this anymore. U.S. media started to report on the U.S. involvement. They talked about how the U.S. government gave Ethiopians the green light for the invasion, gave them the intelligence that they needed for the invasion, that even special operations forces were sent into Somalia in addition to these airstrikes. So this all came out in the mainstream media. And it didn't come out until later. It came out much more quietly. And today, most of that seems to have been forgotten in the coverage.
Now, one of the reporters that sort of took the bait on the notion that the U.S. was actually trying to play a peacekeeper role before the war broke out was New York Times reporter Jeffrey Gettleman. He's played a peculiar, if somewhat erratic, role in the story. Tell us about his reporting.
The New York Times has covered some of this stuff. They've basically, at one point or another, all of this information that I've just been talking about has come out in the New York Times, much of it under Gettleman's byline. But he'll report one day on some of these things, and then just a week or even a few days later, he'll file another report that completely erases the U.S. role. For a U.S. media outlet, particularly a prominent media outlet like the New York Times, to not mention the U.S. and the U.S.'s role a single time in a piece on what's going on in Somalia is just really incredible. But I think, you know, it is related to the reluctance to point fingers at the administration. So some of this stuff has come out, and, you know, they have to acknowledge it at some point, but then they just go and kind of cover it up again.
And of course, the invasion and installation of a favorable regime came at a cost. Could you tell us a little about that and how the situation is being covered today?
Basically, from day one when the Ethiopian troops invaded, there were flagrant human rights abuses that have been well documented by various NGOs. Today, there's a recent report by Refugees International that called Somalia the most neglected crisis in the world. Thousands of civilians have been killed, more than 1 million people have been displaced, and more than 2 million people in need of humanitarian aid, and this is in a country of 9 or 10 million people, so the proportions are pretty staggering. The reporting today talks about this crisis, but I think the main problem is that it refuses still to talk about the U.S. support for the Ethiopian troops, which is there with the U.S.'s blessing. The other point that I feel is missing from current coverage is to really talk about the illegitimacy of the transitional government, which is being pointed to as this last great hope, when really most Somalis see it as illegitimate, a puppet government of the Ethiopians and the U.S. Until the issues of the Ethiopian troops being in Somalia and the illegitimacy of the transitional government, until those two issues are resolved, there's not going to be any peace in Somalia. And until the U.S. media start addressing those issues, it's going to be hard to see change in U.S. policy.
We've been speaking with Julie Haller. Her report, Rediscovering Somalia, can be read in the April issue of Fares Magazine Extra. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Julie Haller.
It's my pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the media watch group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. You can listen to Counterspin at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show was engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.